Good day, everyone, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We are coming up on the annual observance of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, a day that is not just important for its look back at the life and the deeds of the civil rights leader that it is named for, but for the occasion that it inspires, I think, in all of us to think about race and racism, history, and the way that all of those things kind of swirl together to produce the events and the tensions and the dynamics that we all live with today. Wayne State University, of course, will be one of many local institutions that will celebrate Dr. King's life and legacy with special programs in the coming days. And this year, the theme of Wayne State's celebration is looking back to look ahead, which the university says, quote, will reflect on Dr. King's teachings and how we live them today and into the future. It will be a virtual event taking place this Friday, January 14th, at 10 a.m. And you can find out more information and RSVP for the event at go.wayne.edu/MLK-2022. My first guest today is a native Detroiter who has gone on to do some pretty incredible things in Washington, D.C., and he will offer the keynote speech at Wayne State University's celebration. Christopher Wilson is Director of Experience Design and the African American History Program at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, and he joins us now to talk about his work. Christopher, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you so much, Stephen. It's wonderful to be here.
Yeah. So first of all, I am really happy to welcome a native Detroiter back to Detroit, but also a fellow graduate of U of D Jesuit, which is the high school that I attended, and the University of Michigan, which is where I went to college. You are very much of this place.
That's right. Yes, we crossed paths. I think you're a few years behind me. Yes. at both institutions, but we were there at the same time. I think I was a senior and you were a freshman. Yes. at U of D, and then probably the same situation at Michigan.
Yeah, yeah. So I would imagine that it's always nice to be able to come home and talk about the work that you do in Washington. One of the things that I think is most important and interesting about that work is how you teach the history of Dr. King and the civil rights movement to students. We've been having some really politically charged conversations lately as a nation about how we teach history and race in schools. And there are a lot of people who think we ought to teach less of it than we do right now. You founded the National Youth Summit, which is an award-winning series that convenes thousands of middle schoolers and high schoolers around these kinds of conversations. I wonder if you can talk about how you approach these topics with young people and what you make of the conversation that we're having about how we introduce the nation's history and the difficulties around that history to young people.
Sure. Well, you know, I think I can start by saying that when I came to the Smithsonian in Washington at the American History Museum, I worked at Henry Ford Museum for a number of years and worked on programs around the civil rights movement, but also a lot of programs for young people. And I came to the Smithsonian to run our African American History program, which had been founded by Dr. Bernice Johnson Regan, who's a scholar, an activist herself, one of the original members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee Freedom Singers, and then the founder of the a cappella black women singing group Sweet Honey in the Rock. Mm. She came to the Smithsonian with an idea to collect and interpret the civil rights story from a perspective of the foot soldiers of the movement. So she started the African American History Program, but also our celebration and commemoration of the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. But she did the latter by talking about people other than Dr. Martin Luther King, because she really wanted to show that this movement was a movement both of the leaders like King, but also of ordinary people, thousands of ordinary people who made a decision to cross the line that told them, you know, the line that they knew if they crossed it meant they might get killed. And they decided to put their bodies on a line, on the line, to force a change in this country. And really, when I say force a change, I mean, that's really what it was. It wasn't that they were sort of, you know, asking for rules and laws and so forth to be changed, but demanding it and using their own bodies as tools and as weapons in a nonviolent campaign. So she'd done that for a long time with certain types of programs. I brought more of an interest in talking to young people to the study and the interpretation around the civil rights movement. And so one of the things, yes, I did was to in 2010 and 11 found our National Youth Summit there, which really came out of their civil rights work, but it was an idea to get as many young people on one particular day around the country and around the world talking about history that was still relevant today. So several of them have been civil rights topics like Freedom Summer and the Freedom Rides, mm-hmm. But we've also done things like the Dust Bowl and environmental issues and modern day slavery and human trafficking and so forth. And the team that is now sort of taking over the Youth Summit have recently done a really wonderful one on gender equity this past year.
And so what do you make of this dialogue around teaching the history of race and racism in America to kids in the political rhetoric that it is kind of soaked in right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's interesting and saddening that I think 2 years ago we were as a nation at a place where we seemed really interested and willing and ready to have a deeper conversation about systemic racism. And now, you know, we're seeing laws passed to say we shouldn't discuss, mm-hmm. you know, that it'd make it illegal to discuss systemic racism. For me, working at museums and working in the public history space, this has always been somewhat of an issue. And I think the civil rights movement has been a topic that we cover and we think about in a couple different ways. I'm really fascinated by and work to study and help people understand that history and memory or myth or nostalgia are different things. Mm-hmm. That history, that there is the search for what the truth about what happened in the past that historians do based on evidence. And that's what history is. Memory is something different. It's usually what we take from it. It's a simpler story, a less complicated story, a story that usually has morals and values associated with it that history maybe doesn't. And we usually try to simplify, even in museums, simplify a story down to those sort of memory and nostalgic issues. And civil rights movement is a perfect example of that, because with Dr. King, for instance, we remember a few words from usually just one speech.
One speech, yeah.
And not even the whole I Have a Dream speech. And, you know, we remember his theme of a colorblind society. And we remember things like love and so forth, which, of course, he was about. We create this day as a day of service, because who could be against a day of service? You and I both went to school with Jesuits and know the theme of men for others. And I'm sure you had a lot of service projects, and I did, and believe that that's really important. But that's not what Dr. King's message was really about. When something like the Rosa Parks bus, which I worked on when he was at Henry Ford Museum, or the Greensboro lunch counter, which is one of the iconic objects at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History, come into a museum, it gains with it sort of a respectability and a lack of radicalness that where people think, well, of course, if I were there, I would have supported this. Mm-hmm. Of course, I would have been a part of the movement. And of course, it's mean and wrong to separate people. But you can just easily look at polls of the 1960s and see that most people were against the tactics of the movement and the leaders of the movement and it was really radical. So what we're trying to do, what I try to do, is really try to get some of that more complicated history into the story, so that people can better understand it and hopefully understand our current day better.
Yeah. So that's a really fine line to try to walk, I guess, between the things that you were just talking about, the difference between history and memory, the difference between memory and myth. And it's an interesting, I guess, construct in which to think of the work of museums, which, as you point out, kind of have to deal with all of those and then present a story that is factual, is true. Talk about how at the Smithsonian, I guess, you balance all of those things. Can you give us some examples of the ways in which you have to kind of contend with all of those things to present something that people can draw the right value away from?
Sure. Well, I think, first of all, oftentimes when folks come to museums, when visitors come to museums, there and the way we think of history, we really want to use it as something where there are these definite lessons and where those lessons can make us feel comfortable. You know, we want to, generally, though, history, I think, and you should be very skeptical about any history that does make you feel comfortable, because those answers are much less clear the more you look at it and the more you accept the complexity that is there. But because that is where visitors are often coming, we have to somewhat meet them where they are, and hopefully allow learning to take place on their own terms, because we do work in an informal learning space, a space where people are, no one's forced to go to a museum,
sure.
Except maybe on some school field trips and so forth.
Right.
Used things, tactics like museum theater. We have one of our really popular and long-running experiences is called Join the Student Sit-Ins. Mm-hmm. And I mentioned we have the Greensboro lunch counter at the museum. And in 2008, we started doing a show in front of it called Join the Student Sit-Ins, where we take people through a training session on what it would, how people would be trained to participate in sit-ins. And we base this on the interviews with people who'd been through it, Congressman John Lewis, Diane Nash, the actual Greensboro Four, and others. And the idea really was to not show the first day of the sit-in in February 1st, 1960, but show what that looked like a month or 2 months or so forth down the road, and allow visitors to take part in this training session and think about whether they would have the courage, the fortitude, the commitment to be nonviolent, but also put their bodies on the line to force a change and demand a new nation, which is really what the folks were doing then. And so we've been running that for now more than 10 years, and more than a million people have gone through that program. And what I think, one of the things I think it helps people do that you can't get out of a out of other sources of educational, of learning for history, is that it allows really emotional learning. People come away with an experience that they've partaken in with other people that they don't know, which I think is one of the great things about the Smithsonian. Our secretary, Lonnie Bunch, who formerly the founder of the Smithsonian African American History and Culture Museum, and now became our first historian secretary of the Smithsonian, and I think in some ways is sort of the nation's historian. Mm-hmm. You know, as he says, you know, the Smithsonian has this ability to kind of break down bubbles. So what we try to do is to really try to get people who don't know each other to talk to each other. And so a lot of our theater programs, like Join the Student Sit-Ins, try to do that. And because we have this platform, we have this forum where we hopefully can bring people together. And we think that sort of conversation among Americans and people from around the world about history in a safe space like the Smithsonian can create a better future.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Christopher Wilson, Director of Experience Design and the African American History Program at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. We want to hear from you during this conversation as well. We're coming up on the MLK Day holiday. How are you reflecting this year on Dr. King's life and his work as we get closer to MLK Day? What about his teachings or his writings is most illuminating to you right now about the world we live in? What do you think he would say about America in 2022? And what do you make of the conversation that we're having nationally about the history of race and racism in America, how we teach it to children, how we contend with it today, how we confront the inequalities that it still foists upon us all the time? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page, put comments there, or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. Listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. What do you think when you think about the history of race and racism in this country? Does it make you uncomfortable to talk about the things that have happened that have an influence over the things that we face today? Is it hard to find a way to talk about these things with somebody of a different race? To get at the kind of truths about emotion and experience that help bring about understanding. As we get closer to this year's celebration of Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday, the birth of one of our most important civil rights leaders, we're talking about how we think about race and racism in history, how we think through the things that have happened in our country and where they leave us today. Our guest right now is Christopher Wilson, Director of Experience Design and the African American History Program at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. He is going to deliver the keynote address at Wayne State University's 2022 Dr. Martin Luther King Day celebration. We want to hear from you as well as we get closer to MLK Day. What are you thinking about Dr. King's life and work here in 2022? What about his teachings or his writings has influence over the way you think about race and racism today? And what do you think he would say about America in 2022? Also, how much do you really know about Martin Luther King Jr.? The things he said, the things he did. How much were you taught as a young person about Martin Luther King Jr.? Do you feel like you were told enough about who he was, who he really was, what he really believed, what he was willing to do and to sacrifice? Or were you given kind of a surface version of the work that he did? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to the WDET Facebook page and put comments there, or go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today and we'll work you into the conversation. Also, give us a call and let us know what you think about the current conversation in Washington about the Voting Rights Act. President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris really starting to take aim at the idea of reinvigorating voting rights legislation in this country, putting some real pressure on members of their own party and on Republicans to think about the fairness that still eludes so much of the voting process here in America. Is that an appropriate, I guess, cast forward of the things that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about in the 1960s and working for? Can you imagine that 50 years later, we are still having the same conversations about that? Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. You can also go to Facebook or Twitter, put comments there, and we'll work you into the conversation. Christopher, before we get to listeners, I want to give you a chance to talk about what you will talk about when you take part in Wayne State's virtual MLK Day event this Friday.
Well, I think really the last point you made about King, you really previewed it pretty well, because one of the things I'm going to talk about is that this idea of how much we really know King and mm-hmm. what we really celebrate. And I think that one of the things that, as I mentioned, about how we view and present history in museums, but also with things like statues and street names and, you know, and holidays even, where we make the history, we turn it into memory. Mm-hmm. We create nostalgia, and we create simple, comfortable stories. We've definitely created a comfortable, ahistorical Dr. King. And it's one that everybody feels like they feel favorably about and they admire and like. A couple of years ago, there was a poll just before the pandemic started, and more than 90% of U.S. adults said they viewed Dr. King favorably. And many other people of the movement, particularly like a Rosa Parks, was about 88%. And even Muhammad Ali, who was denigrated through the 60s, was viewed as almost 80% positive. So, but that's partly because we changed their history and we remember a few comfortable things about it. I think if people knew King better, that those numbers unfortunately would go down, but I think we'd be in a better and a more honest space. When you look at the history of the movement, and particularly the iconic protests like the Montgomery bus boycott, like the sit-in movement and the freedom rides and so forth, what we remember about that is, well, they were trying to get rid of segregation. And of course, segregation is bad. Of course, separating people with these obvious, obviously unconstitutional, obviously unfair rules and laws are bad, and we should have gotten rid of that. But what they were really fighting for, really from the beginning, was that segregation was the most obvious point of a systemic racism sword that was keeping African Americans in a servile condition. And Martin Luther King, Rosa Parks were very open about that. From the start, it was really about remaking a society and destroying. They wouldn't have used the term systemic racism, but that's what they were talking about. They were talking about systems of oppression. And so in some place like Montgomery, it wasn't just that that the buses were segregated and other facilities were segregated, but also people couldn't get jobs downtown. People were forced into certain places of employment and types of employment, housing was not just segregated, but inferior. Schooling was inferior. And so it was this system that that segregation was the point of, that they were trying to destroy and destroy it. I think the other thing that is really amazing about that movement is that every movement leader and activist that I've ever interviewed, from Rosa Parks to Diane Nash to Congressman Lewis to the Greensboro Four, all of them came to this from a emotion of anger, mm-hmm. of being frustrated, being angry, and not just angry to the point of despondentness. The Greensboro Four, Frank McCain, Joe McNeil, Ezell Blair, and David Richmond, said they felt suicidal as teenagers because they'd seen some progress. They'd seen the Brown versus Board of Education case declared and segregation in public schools ending or being, ordered to end. It didn't actually end, but being ordered to end in 1954 when they were about 12 years old. And Frank McCain told me that his father said then, well, everything is going to change now. And when we think of it in a history book, we think, okay, well, 1954 to 1964, a lot changed and a lot of these rules changed and so forth. But when you're 12 years old and you head off to college maybe in a few years and you don't see any changes at all, and those years felt like a long time. And so this came out of this this feeling of anger, of resentment, mm-hmm. And so forth. But I think the amazing thing was so many of them turned to nonviolent direct action as a tactic and turned that anger into a positive direction. But I think one of the things that we think of when we think of the nonviolence, then we think of it as, and when we often even use the term passive resistance, mm-hmm. but it wasn't passive at all. It was active. People like Diane Nash, after the bombing of the church in Birmingham, the terrible terrorist attack that killed four little girls at Sunday school, right after Martin Luther King had delivered his "I Have a Dream" speech in Washington, right after when we think of it now, we think of this moment when everyone was coming together. Well, the backlash to that was blowing up four little girls. Diane Nash felt like that was the last straw. And she and her then husband, James Bevel, were entreated King to start a massive movement that would, put things like what we've seen during Black Lives Matter and so forth to shame, because they intended to have a giant movement that would shut down Alabama and even the whole country, nonviolently, but still very, very aggressively and radically, because they just felt like, human beings could not allow this sort of violence and terrorism to stand.
Right, right. We have a social media question from Dr. Liette Gidlow, who teaches here at Wayne State University. She says, what's the role of the Smithsonian American History Museum in our current historical moment when Americans are deeply divided over what is true and real and democracy seems imperiled? We were talking a little about that earlier, but I think that's a more direct question about, I guess, what the museum sees really as its role, as Americans have this pretty spirited argument over what inclusion means, what democracy means, what fairness looks like. Talk just a little about how you guys think that through there.
Yeah, well, I think I would encourage anyone to come to our website, come to our programs that are online, come eventually. We are open 5 days a week right now in Washington, D.C. But when you feel like you can safely travel and visit us to do so, our director, Dr. Anthea Hartig, has come in. I say new director because she started just before the pandemic, and it seems like time has stopped in some ways, but it certainly hasn't in a lot of senses, because she's decided that and made a decision that this museum, the National Museum of American History, will be the most accessible, inclusive, relevant, sustainable public history institution in the nation, or that we can in the next years. And one of the things that we've done as a tangible, as something really tangible to speak to that, is create a new Center for Restorative History. And you can check that out again if you go to our website and learn about the Center for Restorative History, which has just begun under the direction of Dr. Sion Wold-Michael. And that idea is that, you know, history has power, and history has ability to harm people, and we want to reduce the harm that has been done by history that has been forgotten or not told and erased as much as that has been told. We also have created, and I was involved in this along with our chief curator Benjamin Filene and a team of my colleagues. We wrote a new interpretive plan for the museum to really speak to much more of an interest in active learning and really telling those really more inclusive stories that maybe museums of the past have not done. And then I think thirdly, my goal for all the years I've really been there is to dedicate ourselves to becoming that kind of forum that I mentioned earlier, being a place where people can come together share their thoughts, again, with people they don't know. I think that one thing that's really special and powerful about the Smithsonian is that convening power that we have. When before I took the job, again, my mentor and the director of the founding director of the African American History Program at the American History Museum at the Smithsonian, Bernice Regan, one of the things she told me was never forget and never take for granted the convening power that we have. It's at first I didn't quite know exactly what she meant. I mean, one of the things that's definitely true is when you work at the Smithsonian and you call up just about anybody on the phone and say, I'm calling from the Smithsonian, they don't hang up on you. And so there's that sort of convening power that we can pull together, you know, speakers and historians and, you know, celebrities and artists and so forth and scientists, you know, most of the Smithsonian is actually science, into panels and discussions and so forth. And so we can do that. But also, just the fact that the way that visitors themselves come to the museum, they come with an openness where they will engage in conversation with one another. And so I've always said that what, you know, more even than teaching about history, what I really say that I try to do is use history to get people who didn't know each other yesterday to talk to each other and to meet in this historical space. Mm-hmm. But really what I hope that they learn is respect and better understanding for their fellow humans, you know, who also visit the museum. And hopefully we can create more of an honest dialogue in that way. So again, I recommend anyone take a look at our website and take a look at some of the new work that we've done and that we will be rolling out, especially as things get back to normal.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, Christopher Wilson, Director of Experience Design in the African American History Program at the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. It was really great to have you here to have this conversation, and we look really much forward to your speech on Friday as part of Wayne State University's MLK Day celebration. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Stephen, and you know, go Cubs, go Blue, and go Warriors at Wayne State.
That's right. Okay, we're gonna take another quick break, and when we come back, we're gonna change the subject slightly. We're gonna hear about the Washington Post's new investigation, which reveals that 1,700 members of Congress once enslaved black people. We're going to talk about who they were and how they shaped American history and our nation as we know it today. Stay with us for more Detroit Today.